With great pleasure, I'm turning it over to Patrick to share his experience, strength, and hope with us. And if you could speak because it's such a small meeting, you can speak as long as you need to, Patrick. So I'm going to turn it over to you. Thank you for allowing me to be of service. And you are on. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Patrick, and I'm an addict. And thank you,
Hello,
Michael.
Patrick.
Hello.
Welcome. Woohoo.
Hello. It's an honor always to be asked to speak. And Michael and I actually go back to a meeting that I loved in San Francisco that was called the Pumpkin Meeting. And I can't remember how early in the 2000s it was, but yeah, it wasn't a very big meeting, just like this one, and yet I got so much out of it, and I looked forward to it. And I met friends there, and and then I would see Michael at other meetings, and it's just always great to see someone. And the craziest thing is that there were about five people in this meeting when I showed up last week, or I think it was last week. And that just shows you that Narcotics Anonymous is just an amazing thing, that you can be in a meeting from another country and still know somebody in the meeting. I had the privilege one time of going to a meeting in Germany, and I did not know anything that they were saying, but I heard everything they were saying. Meaning I didn't know the language at all, even though my background is I'm Irish and German. And yet I could relate because I'm an addict, and addicts, I believe, can understand other addicts. One act, helping each other is without parallel. It's an amazing thing. This program gave me my life when I was trying to extinguish it at a pretty young age. I had tried to commit suicide three times before coming into Narcotics Anonymous. My background was I was a lead singer in a band. I had fallen in love with my drummer's girlfriend, because I think matters of the heart are part of the reason. It's actually one of the In my experience, it has been, matters of the heart are something that just, okay, if somebody passes away, I've been able to deal with that. If it's something, having to do with job loss, I have been able to deal with that. If it's somebody getting very, very sick, I've been able to deal with that. Matters of the heart, stems from another addiction for me, which is an addiction to sex and love, which I didn't find out until very much later in my recovery. When I walked into my first NA meeting on July 14th of 1998, I brought there by a using buddy's friend. And I was actually looking for a dealer for another drug that I was not very accustomed to, but wanted to switch to. And he never showed up. And I got to think that that is a higher power working in my life. And I didn't even know it. And I was brought up Catholic. And by the time I was coming into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, I had a full on, I don't want to say hatred for God, but just a feel like, as I'm wearing a Depeche Mode shirt right now, and there's a great song called Blasphemous Rumors, and I really thought that God had a sick sense of humor, and when I die, I expect to find him laughing. That was my sense of a God of my understanding. And today I have a higher power, and which sometimes I call God, and sometimes I call my higher power. And if you're new to recovery, doesn't really matter which one it is. It could be Buddha, it could be Jesus, it could be Muhammad. It doesn't really matter. just as long as it's a power bigger than myself. And I know atheists and agnostics, and they're still clean. Because I think it's my own personal experience, and I don't speak for Narcotics Anonymous. I speak as a member of Narcotics Anonymous, is that it is about wanting to stay clean. You know, what I love in our 12 traditions is talking about the desire to stay clean, because it never pushes people out. It never says you don't belong here. I was 20 years old on July 14th, 1998, when I walked into my first meeting, and nobody ever said, "You're a kid, you haven't used enough, you know, you don't have any tattoos, you don't ride a bike." And you know, this was still at the time of work the steps or die, mother F, you know. The steps, the fourth, the or sorry, the step working guide didn't exist yet. And I remember going to that meeting, and I remember people talking about birthdays, and there were three people that were sitting next to each other, and they were all celebrating a birthday. And I thought, this is really weird. We're celebrating birthdays in this thing. And you know, I first thought that this was a cult. I thought, you know, this was going to be something that was, you know, just like, I don't know, David Koresh or Waco or whatever it was going to be. Boy, was I wrong. I was so wrong. And I loved that when I went to that meeting, and I got up and I shared, you know, and I was whining and I was crying, and it was all about a girl, and it led me to, you know, wanting to commit suicide. And of course, through working the steps, I realized it wasn't all about a girl. It was all about a lot of things that I would find through working, you know, all 12 steps, and especially the fourth step. What else I found was that when I came into my first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, I judgment of people. I would sit in judgment, and I would think, "You are this, you're that, you're this, you're that." I was scared of low income African American communities like East Palo Alto, if anyone's ever heard of it. Because I was just scared. You know, when you are not familiar with something, it breeds fear. I will never forget the man who hugged me and told me to keep coming back. And he was somebody that I probably would have never hung out with, and I actually was scared of him. He was from East Palo Alto. He was black. And he hugged me, and I never stopped going to that meeting until I left that part of Northern California. And I will never forget that hug. And I won't, you know, never forget people of all different ethnicities and everything that have been there for me in my recovery. I got a sponsor when I first came in. My sponsor had a ponytail. He listened to metal. I was a metal singer in a band. And thinking to myself that, you know, I could manipulate this guy, but he had a girlfriend and he was very smart. And I thought, well, you know, I can manipulate this guy, and I can get over on this guy, and blah, blah, blah. Oh God, was I wrong. He would tell me at the end of meetings, you know, "Shut up. You don't know anything." And that was tough love. And I needed that, because being the youngest of five kids, you know, it was all about me. Even 2 years before I came into the program, my band members and, well, my first band got me a t-shirt that said, "The lead singer, me, blah, 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 me." When I read the IP, the Triangle of Self-Obsession, I thought it was written about me. Because that's the way my life was when I first came in. Everything revolved around me. Everything you said, I took personally. I had the thinnest skin, and I had an absolute hatred for myself. I didn't even have low self-esteem. I had no self-esteem. And my first sponsor taught me things like up to people after a meeting and ask them about themselves. And don't talk about you. I want you to ask them questions about them. And that's not necessarily working the steps, but that led me into realizing that I'm powerless over my addiction to self. And of course, I am powerless over my addiction to substances. But I believe that I started out as an addict way before I ever put a drug in my body. I'm a person that I feel like there was always something missing inside, a hole that I couldn't fill. And so as young as, 8 years old, I can remember taking butter and putting it in sugar and just eating it and just getting a high off of it and going and getting into the frosting and eating that and eating that and eating that. And I can recall trying to buy my friends because I wanted friends, because I felt so alone. I felt so lonely and I felt so alone. And even though I had a mother and father who loved me very much, I just always felt like something was missing. And so constantly until I was 20 years old, whether it was cigarettes or girls or drugs, I was always trying to fill something that could never be filled, could never be filled. And even today with 23 plus years clean, I struggle with it. Steps many times, and it's a constant struggle. And the thing is that it's a choice every single moment and every single day to not take anything when I want to escape Patrick. And that's the thing is that I always want to escape me. I went into acting when I was in high school because I wanted to be another character. I didn't want to be Patrick. Hated myself. I had a weight problem. I had been abused a couple times on sleepovers where I was actually molested by a boy on a sleepover. And I struggled with, am I gay? Am I straight? Am I gay? Am I straight? Is this my fault? Did I like that? Is it okay that I enjoyed the sensations? Blah, 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 blah. And all of that, and really feeling that self-hatred, and feeling like, you know what, I'm not worth anything, and thinking that, that led to me wanting to end my life three times. And when I came into the program and I had this sponsor for 2 years, I really followed everything he did, but I put him up on a pedestal, which I'm sure a lot of you in this room have a sponsor, and I don't ever suggest putting them on a pedestal because what I learned is when I put somebody on a pedestal or I have expectations, they're just planned resentments. And suddenly at one point he was telling me, I want you to be just like me. And maybe I didn't really understand that, but that's what I took. And so I left that sponsor. And I have this sponsor that I've had now for 22 years, and I love him. I lost my father in 2018, and it was it, it it broke my heart. And my sponsor, I don't want to say he's taken over the role of like a father figure, but he is definitely somebody. I didn't want to say but because that sounds like I'm trying to make excuses. I always learned in recovery saying, but, although, however, all lead to manipulative statements, and saying woulda, coulda, shoulda leads to just thinking about the past and not finding a solution in the moment. So when I say that my sponsor has been there for me, he's been there for me. He's shown me tough love. He stood with me when I got married in 2015 as my best man. At my side. I mean, how cool is that? When my sponsor, who saw me basically as a kid at 22, even just last week, he said, you have grown so much in the last 22 years. And I know for a lot of us, we can't see that. within ourselves, other people can, because we have a dis-ease, and that's what I call it, a dis-ease. It always wants to make me feel uneasy, that wants to ruin everything, and will always tell me I'm a piece of S, you know, that will always wake up in the middle of the night at times and make me feel, you don't deserve to have a kid, you don't deserve to be married, you don't have a real job anymore, you can blame COVID or whatever, but blah, 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 blah. My dis-ease will always be there. And so every single moment of every single day, I make the choice to surrender and go, yeah, you're more powerful than I am. And I absolutely know that you are more powerful than I am. I do have ADHD, so I'm sorry if I skip around a little bit. I went to college one time, and I was talking to somebody about how I was in recovery, and it had been at that point around 3.5 years, and I was really feeling really, really strong and mighty, and like I could take on the world. And there was a guy right behind me that was letting me know that if I ever wanted to go back to my old ways, he was right there. And what he was telling me was he could, you know, sell to me at any time. I, you know, he could hook me up. And I took that as, that's just like the dis-ease sitting on my shoulder saying, I got you. Don't ever think you have this because you don't. Don't ever think you have this because you don't. And I couldn't do this alone. I give love to my sponsor, but there are so many men and women in this program who have been there for me. And it is a we program. You know, Triangle of Self-Obsession may be the IP that I really relate to. This is a we program. Sometimes when I'm reading the How It Works, I always emphasize we. And some people will say after I say that, they're like, I really liked how you really emphasized we, because it is we. You know, I mean, Michael being there, you know, when I came to this meeting a few weeks ago, that was like, wow. Cool, somebody I know is in a meeting across the Atlantic, you know, across Ireland. I mean, that's just like a higher power working in my life, you know. Even before the meeting today, right before the meeting, I was reading a story to my son because I promised him I would. And he got this story, and it was about chameleons. And that's what I believe as an addict I am. I'm a chameleon. I could fit in anywhere, because addicts are chameleons in my experience, and we adapt to our environment, you know, because it's all about survival, you know, and it is all about survival. And the funniest thing for me is that as much as I want to survive, there's a part of me that always wants to give up, you know, and not just surrender, but give up the fight. And that's why I say it is a choice every single moment. And I was taught that by another addict who was one of my, quote, road dogs for a long, long time. His father passed away, and I was there for him. When my father passed away, he was there for me. And he taught me that it was about moments, moment to moment, because a day can be too long. You know, I don't know about you guys, but a day can be too long for me. You know, sometimes it really is about moments. I've had the experiences where it was a matter of the heart thing. I was in my first year clean, and then I walked by a bar, and I was really distraught, and I just had to close my eyes because nobody was picking up their phone. I was calling people, and nobody was picking up, and so I had to rely on my higher power, and I had to rely that if I just walked past this bar and not went in, that I'd be okay. If I just didn't call the number of a dealer whose number I still remember, then I would be okay. And you know what? Moment to moment, I got through that. And I walked through it, you know, and that was an amazing thing. And the way that I've been able to do this is because of the steps. You know, I can't say that I work every tradition. I can't say that I've actually worked all of the traditions in a row, you know. I've definitely been a person that has represented the Peninsula area and the Bay Area of Narcotics Anonymous, where, you know, if people had a question about NA, I was the person that they spoke to when it came to the media. So I definitely had to learn about that tradition, you know, and of course the, you know, principles before personalities, because there have been some personalities that have made me want to walk out of a meeting. And, you know, sometimes, especially in early recovery, I just close my eyes and sit on my hands, because that was the best thing that I could do, because I needed to hear the message, even if I didn't like the personality of the person. In my first few meetings, there was a guy who literally did not like me. He told me that, "You sound exactly like me. I can't stand it when you speak, blah, 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 blah." When I graduated college in 2004, 6 years later, he was the one that took me to dinner and, you know, congratulated me for this accomplishment. You know, what I love is that I have over 120 phone numbers in my phone of addicts I could call at any time. And maybe they don't remember me, or maybe I don't remember them, but I could call them. And if they're still working a program, they may say something that I need to hear. Maybe it's a newcomer. Maybe it's a newcomer that just, you know, needs to hear that somebody cares about them. That's what Narcotics Anonymous did for me and continues to do for me, is let me know that people care. We have to, because, you know, as my sponsor has always told me, an addict's most, how would I say this? The way that we function, like where we feel the most free, is using. And that is sick. And unfortunately, you know, we are sick and we are recovering. We're getting better. And that's something that, you know, and yet that never stops. No graduation, Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I've talked to sponsees before, and I was lucky enough a few weeks ago to get some sponsees, because I hadn't had some in a while. COVID really took me out of my element. I moved up into an area 2 hours north of San Francisco, California, where it's very, very different. I'm politically left, and I know NA doesn't have any political affiliations yet. I don't either. Having come up here, though, it seemed like nobody was wearing masks and people weren't getting vaccinated, and I was going to meetings and I was the only one wearing a mask on, and I really didn't feel safe. And so I'm so glad that these Zoom meetings were here, you know, because even though I have not really related to the fellowship over here where I'm at, partly because there's a part of me, my disease, that wants to separate me. And so it's great that I have these, you know, Zoom and Blue Jeans meetings to go to, because they keep me connected to the fellowship. For newcomers coming in, I always give them major kudos to the fact that they're coming in where a time where it's really hard to go to a meeting, because this pandemic, even on the decline, they're coming in and saying, "I've got one day clean." You got one day clean and you're coming in on your phone. I mean, I got hugs when I came in, and I needed those. And people are coming in and having the strength to say, "I need help." There's courage right there. I mean, we are given this gift. And it's only through all my predecessors that I learned these things. Nothing is like, "Oh, you know, I'm Buddha on a mountain came to me and told me all this stuff." You know, no, my predecessors taught me everything that I'm telling you guys. They taught me the steps. They're there for me. The ones that I've seen pass away, a lot of them died clean. Unfortunately, some of my friends that were under the age of 35 died getting loaded, died of suicide, because, I don't know, maybe a higher power had another plan for them. I have no idea. And sometimes I do feel survivor's guilt, because I'm still here and they're not. You know, just couple of years ago, I lost a friend who actually reached out to me and wanted to see how I was doing, because he knew I had a son and he was living in Arizona, and we used to play guitar together. And I I glazed over it. I didn't think about it when he called. And I didn't call him back for a while. And then when I did, I got a voicemail. And then a couple months later, I got a call from a friend of mine in recovery who told me that he OD'd on a speedball. And it was so sad. It was just, it broke my heart because he was very much like me. And we were both in recovery. And I don't know what happened, but life happened. And there was the saddest thing was going to his not memorial, going to this thing that we had for him in the woods. It was just a small little gathering, and his father was drinking Modelos, and really was. Hey, I don't have to hide my pain because I learned 1, 2, and 3. I can't, and I'll let it. And it is whatever, like I said, a higher power, a God, a Buddha, whatever it is. Probably not a doorknob, and definitely not a woman or a drug or food, because I feel like all of those things, for me anyway, or even lottery scratchers, take me to a place where I just want to escape, where I just don't want to deal with life. And so I may not want to use substances anymore. That doesn't mean that I don't want to escape, because I'm an addict. And an addict's most natural way of being is using. And like I said, every day I make the choice that I don't use. And when I got to 1, 2, and 3, and it said, I'll let it, and trying to figure out what it was, my assignment from my sponsor was, I want you to go research different religions. And I want you to think about what you would want your higher power to have. What are the characteristics you would want your higher power to have? It's kind of like make your own higher power, whether to be, loving completely, without, like no, I don't even know the word to say, but just absolutely loving, any restraints, and to be forgiving, and all these things that I grew up with, a God I didn't feel was these things, and that was really great. It was something that I struggled with because the third step was let it, giving your will and your life over to something else when it, unless I'm really, really grounded and paying attention to the amazing things that happen in my life, like my son's book that I read right before coming to this meeting, having to do with chameleons and reminding me, we are chameleons. Addicts are chameleons. And when I got to that third step, and I got to my first fourth step, I can remember it was over 453 pages long. It was longer than the basic text, and I didn't get anything out of it. I scratched the surface. The only thing I learned was that I had patterns of behavior, that I had patterns. So all my resentments that I had toward people that I went to high school with or girls and stuff like that, I looked at my part. And that was cool because then I didn't have to feel like I was a victim. I looked at my part. And and I love the way it was structured, even in the fourth step working guide, which came out before, the step working guide, because it ends with your assets. So I did all this work, and as somebody once said to me in a meeting, it's like you climb over a mountain, and when you get done with the fourth step, you get to the other side, and it feels so amazingly free because all of these assets are there to show me that I'm not a piece of S, that I am worth something, that I may have been hurtful in my patterns and the way I treated people in the past, whether it be women or my parents or all those things. Share it. And that was scary, the time I ever had to share it. And some of the things that happened that I had to share, I didn't know whether or not somebody was going to be able to comprehend that. And of course, as a lot of us know, if you've worked the fifth step, is that they probably said, yeah, I had that too. Yeah, I did that too. Okay. Nobody said, "Oh man, you're weird, dude. You're really weird," you know, or anything like that. There was no judgment, you know, and that was the great thing about the fifth step. And it made me feel closer to my first sponsor and also my current sponsor. And then when the sixth step, when I'm writing down my character defects, and I thought, oh, okay, well, I'm writing down all the things that I do to get over and manipulate and all these other things. I got to write down the corresponding principles to those. And in the seventh step, really ask for my character defects to be removed and focus on the corresponding principles, which are, you know, if I'm, you know, lying to be truthful, if I'm selfish to be humble, and things of that nature, and really just focus on those things because they mean so much, because that's how I recover. You know, as we all probably know, this program is not just about staying clean. Staying clean, you can be white knuckling and staying clean, and I'm not learning anything if I'm just white knuckling it. I have to stay clean and also do the work. My area of the peninsula, I had a nickname back in the time where we had nicknames in recovery when I came in, and mine was Melodramatic Pat. And Melodramatic Pat might have been melodramatic, and like I said, I am an actor, and so you know I could be melodramatic, but my sponsor would always stand up for me for anybody that put me down and said, you know, he's one of the hardest young people working in recovery, and he will do the work because he wants to change and he wants this program. And it kind of shut some people up that would make fun of me. You know what? And also, guess what? Higher power, and I'm not it. And what other people think of me is none of my business. Unless they want to make it my business. And then, yeah, I can have a resentment. But what I learned is when I have a resentment towards somebody else, I take the poison and hope that they die. We know that that doesn't work. So the seventh step is continual, and it's you know it can be difficult because I have to focus on the corresponding principles to my character defects. The eighth step, in my experience, is the easiest step there is to work in recovery because basically it's writing down all the people that I need to make amends to. And it's just writing it. It's not doing it. It's writing it. And then going to my sponsor and saying, look, this is what, you know, these are the people. And my dealers were on some of those. And he said, I don't think that's a great idea. And that's the great thing about our predecessors is, you know, they let us know through their own experiences what works and what doesn't work. Going back to a dealer that I may have ripped off and saying, I'm really sorry. I also learned that. The ninth step is not about being sorry. It's about making amends, a living amends to some people that are not dead or that are dead, and also making a lifelong amends to things that I did, like when I stole from people, you know, when I stole from my parents, when I did things, when I, you know, when I manipulated people, when I made people cry, when I would get people to just feel sorry for me or all the things that I did, you know, I never hit a jail. I did hit the institutions. And I owe an amends to an ex-girlfriend. 10 years ago, I was in a psych ward, you guys. I was in a psych ward because I couldn't deal with the fact that an ex-girlfriend fell in love with a guy 13 years younger than her. And it all just became about that the little kid inside me was hurt that I was in a sandbox. And somebody else was playing with the toy that I didn't want anymore. And yet I didn't know that because my disease just wanted to take me to the edge. And I went into a psych ward and I even made a death threat against him 10 years ago. And when they let me out of the psych ward, I went into a meeting and I shared all this. And you know what I got after that meeting? I had six men who wanted me to sponsor them. And I went to my sponsor. I said, really? Are you serious? And he said, you know why? I said, no. He said, because you didn't get loaded. You went through that. And you went through the humiliation. It got into the paper that I made a death threat on somebody. I had police officers come and interrogate me. I didn't get loaded. You know, I went through the pain. I even went to another 12-step program to deal with that, you know, because I just needed to relate to people that had that specific thing. And my sponsor was totally okay with that, you know. And doing ninth step amends, I once was on my third step trying to do a ninth step amends to an ex-girlfriend, and that didn't really work out so well. As we know that logistically, if you stand on stairs, okay, if you try to jump from the third to the ninth step, you're gonna fall. What happened? Because I was like, I'm sorry for this and I'm sorry for that, because I'd never worked the ninth step. I was on the third. And then I started saying, but you were a this and you were a that and you were a this. And I learned humility in that moment. And I learned to be humiliated in that moment. Well, the reason why I bring up the other ex is because the lifelong amends to the woman that, you know, I went to the psych ward and she actually took me to the psych ward because I was just so out of my mind obsessed, you know, which is part of my addiction, is the obsession to use, the obsession to need something to fill me inside. You know, the thing was that my lifelong amends is I won't contact her. My sponsor has even said, I really think that your lifelong amends should be you don't contact her. You don't write her a letter. You know, I wrote her a letter and I shared it with my sponsor. That was the ninth step for me for that amends. You know, because I feel like in not contacting her, I'm actually doing a living amends by doing that. Tenth step, I don't do it every day. I did do it from like 2001 to 2003 on a pretty consistent basis. I probably would be a little happier if I did do it every day. You know, I mean, the 10th step frees me up to do the 11th step, which I know I'm talking so much. The 11th step helped me to listen and learn and hear my higher power, my God of my understanding by meditating. And now my wife and I do that every night. Sometimes it, you know, I'm married and sometimes it's really difficult with a 4.5-year-old who I love very, very much. And my wife and I, we get along and sometimes we fight and sometimes it's great and sometimes it's not. So in meditating, we're working on a relationship. We're working on being together and being with each other and letting, you know, a higher power give us some guidance and letting us breathe and getting centered. And I'm fortunate that my wife, she's not in recovery. She doesn't use. I've never seen her have a drink or a drug or anything in her in her life. And she chooses to do that, not because of me, just because she chooses to do that. So I'm very fortunate. 12th step, that's where it all comes back. That's where it all is like, I can't keep all these things that I've gotten, you know, to graduate from college, to go to Europe for 2 months and have a blast and not have any drugs and meet people from all over the world. Some of them I still stay in contact with from 2004. And to have a blast, one of the best times of my life, going to 8 different countries. You know, those of you from the UK, I love the UK. I mean, I've always loved the UK from a little boy when I was a fan of the Beatles and obsessed with Duran Duran. I mean, my musical obsession has never actually led me to anything bad. That's the one thing. And I play guitar and I sing and my son sings and it's great. And so I get to share, you know, all this wisdom, all my experience, strength, and hope, I get to share that with my sponsees today and with other addicts and people that have come up to me before and said, you know, I heard you speak at my first meeting. And, you know, and sometimes my ego can get there, and that's the disease. And the ego can get there and say, oh, you're all this in a bag of chips. No, I'm not. I'm an addict in recovery. Some people don't like me, and some people I don't like, and that's the principles before personalities. You know, I didn't get clean to be a saint. I don't think any of us did. I got clean not knowing what was going to happen. You would have told me 4 years ago that I would still be clean. I would have said, are you serious? Yeah, right. No way. I was 20 years old. I went to college and almost gave up because I was like, I'm 23. I need to be free. I need to be partying. I go to San Diego State University. This is a party school, you know. I mean, and my disease can always monkey F me. I don't need to live that way today. Service is the key to staying in it, whether it's sponsorship, whether it's being the literature person. When Zoom meetings first happened, I actually took up a commitment in 2020 of being a secretary for an area that I didn't know. I just wanted to have a commitment. I believe that service keeps you clean. And yet, I believe that you can go to as many meetings as you want. You can do service. You can work the steps. And if want to use, and it's within an arm lengths away, that is always a choice. And I'm sure you probably heard me say choice a lot. And with that, it's like 12 o'clock here, so I'm gonna wrap it up. But I am such a grateful member of Narcotics Anonymous. They taught me to have a life. And even though I don't have the white picket fence or even a house or even a full-time job right now, what I do have is clarity. I have an insight into myself. I'm there for other people today. I think about other people today, and I got rid of my t-shirt that said the lead singer, me, blah, blah, blah. Thanks for letting me share.